BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm John Pienaar. Thanks for clicking on the Pienaar's Politics podcast for another week. There's a few little juicy morsels in the show this week, certainly on the Brexit front. That's what we talk about. But, you know, it just gets bigger and better and more intriguing and more fascinating. You're going to hear, listen especially for Amber Rudd. That will become clear when that one comes along. Make up your own mind. Here's the show. Good morning, I'm John Pienaar. Welcome to Pienaar's Politics. Did you see the latest poll that says people think Boris Johnson's most likely to be our next Prime Minister? No surprise there, he probably will be. But apparently, only one in six of them would buy a second-hand car from him, and the other candidates are hardly more trusted. To quote Boris Johnson's great hero, never in the field of political conflict has so much been promised by so many and believed by so few. Okay, Winston Churchill never said that exactly, but he might have done. BJ says he'd take us out of the EU on October the 31st, with or without a deal, and cut taxes for Tory party members. Well, he said middle and better off earners, especially pensioners, which amounts to the same thing in many cases. Jeremy Hunt, Michael Gove, Sajid Javid, they all say they'd somehow get an EU deal where Theresa May couldn't, and pour cash into tax cuts and public services. I could go on, and they will. A lineup of government ministers from the cabinet down is joining me to convince us all to trust their man to lead the country. If you're a Tory party member, you'll also have a say in choosing the winner. And if not, well, come on, you can't have everything. And with us through the show this morning, Katie Balls is back, deputy editor at The Spectator. Hi, Katie. Thanks for coming in. And Matt Ford's here, commentator and comedian, which just now seems to amount to very much the same thing. Hello, Matt.
Hello. Good morning.
What's in your mind, Matt?
I've become obsessed with the weather. I'm going to Glastonbury week on Wednesday. And I've never been so obsessed with long range weather predictions as I've become in the last 2 days. I've become absolutely paranoid about it. I'm one of those people who always thinks the weather forecast is a waste of television and radio space.
What's the outlook at Glastonbury? Is it going to be okay?
A bit half and half. It's a bit kind of half, bit of rain, bit of sun, bit of cloud.
Okay, that's interesting. When I said what's on your mind, I was thinking vaguely political, but don't worry, the weather's...
Oh, I took it very literally. Well, if not, well, then Jeremy Corbyn's comments about the Iranian oil tanker, well, the oil tanker that was hit by the Iranians or not, I just thought was a bit peculiar. Well, entirely consistent with Corbyn's worldview, but I just think it sends a message. You know, I think it's a further evidence that the post-election discipline that Corbyn and McDonnell had has now completely eroded.
Okay. Katie, what's on your mind?
So I haven't looked at the weather forecast today. I think looking ahead, this is a big week that we're leading up to on the Tory leadership contest. We should know by the end of the week who the final two candidates are. And at the moment, I think looking at all the newspaper reports, it seems like as though Boris Johnson, barring a catastrophe of epic proportions, is going to be one of the final two. So who is going to join him? And I think what's interesting is we're seeing Rory Stewart, wild card, still looks hard for him to get there. But given, I think, how few expected him to get as far as he has done, he this morning has won another endorsement, this time Tobias Aylward, a minister in government. And can he get any more? He has 13 MPs off making it into the next round.
Yeah, he's the star, isn't he? I don't know if he's going to be the PM, but he's the star of the whole show.
I think he's brought an enthusiasm to it, which has actually, in a way, derailed quite a few of his rivals' campaigns. I think it has meant that everyone has had to try and raise their game. And it also has meant that some cabinet candidates have just looked a little bit flat in comparison, because Rory Stewart is just going everywhere with his camera phone, bus stops, parks, filming, having a hashtag.
You know Rory Stewart's absolutely extraordinary rises all to do with this show, right? Because a couple of weeks ago he was a backbencher with interesting things to say. Then the next week had him in, he was in the cabinet as International Development Secretary. And now look, he's knocking on the door of number 10 Downing Street. He's going to be back in a couple of weeks on Pienaar's Politics and we'll tell you all about it. But it may not be Rory Stewart, you know, probably going to be Boris Johnson, but we don't know. Amber Rudd has her own ideas about who it should be, the Work and Pension Secretary. Good morning to you, Amber. Amber, have we got you on the line? I think we might
I'm
have
here. Done. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, and I hope you can hear us.
Yes, I can.
Hope you're well.
Yes, thank you.
Now, tell us, Amber, you're supporting Jeremy Hunt, the Foreign Secretary.
Yes.
We know that. But let me ask you this straight away. It's an obvious question, but a fascinating answer if you've got one. How do you rate the realistic chances of any of the contenders, whether it's your guy Jeremy Hunt or anyone else, getting a Brexit deal through Parliament?
Well, the best chance of getting a Brexit deal through Parliament is being frank about the problems. And some of my concerns with some of the contenders is they're not facing up to the impasse that we're in.
Yeah.
The biggest chance we've got of actually breaking that impasse is A, acknowledging the problems, and B, having a new leader. I mean, I do think that Theresa May had stopped being listened to. Mm. The EU decided she couldn't get a majority, so they weren't going to make any of those final changes that she was trying to reach for. Yeah. And MPs in Parliament had stopped listening to her because they had decided they needed a new leader. So a new leader has a chance to break the impasse by being frank about the problems we have, which are big, but also they'll get a hearing. They might just be able to break that impasse by making sure that people do realise that this is a good shot and coming together under them.
Yeah, I think you may be right about a lot of that, the fact that Theresa May was in the end an obstacle. A lot of them thought they were voting against Theresa May as much or more as they were voting against the deal on offer. And that might, stress might, that might change. But that wasn't actually my question. I was asking you how likely you think that is to happen.
Listen, John, I mean, I really don't know. I mean, we mustn't underestimate the difficulty that we're in. It is a real block that we're in with not being able to form, a majority for what I thought was a good deal between the UK and the EU that we had before, and not being able to get the amendments from the EU that the UK say they'll want. So I'm backing Jeremy Hunt because I think he's the candidate who's most likely to be able to unblock that impasse because he has an approach which is much more consensual. And what I don't think we need is more heating up of the disagreements here. We need somebody who's going to try and bring these sides together.
Yeah, I mean, so far, so important. Those were the answers which I thought you were going to give us, but that doesn't make them less valid for that reason. But in your answers, you accept the obvious implication that if it's not a deal, we could be heading for no deal. You accept that is a clear possibility.
Unless
something stops it. So what's going to stop it?
Well, there's two things about no deal. First of all, we can't necessarily stop it because it's not entirely in our gift. We have an extension until the end of October. If we do end up asking for a further extension, the EU may say no. So it's absolutely right that we have to prepare for no deal because we might not be able to control it. What will actually stop it if the MPs decide that they want to stop it?
Yes.
I don't know the exact answer to that, but I do acknowledge that it's happened before.
Yeah.
When we were able to do it because we weren't ready to leave at that time.
Yeah.
And I feel reasonably confident that we have an inventive parliament, we have an activist speaker, and we have a lot of, cabinet ministers like myself who are very concerned about the prospect of no deal and feel that we must find a way of negotiating a deal.
Right. So knowing as we do, because you've been very upfront about this, you think a no deal would be a catastrophe for the country. You think it should be stopped. If it wasn't stopped in any other way and it came down to parliament, you believe, well, you'd be behind the idea of Parliament stopping a no deal because you think it's so much against the national interest. That's a fair summary so far?
Well, my words are that I believe that a no deal is bad for the economy, bad for the union and bad for security.
Yeah. But you would believe Parliament would be right to do what it takes to stop no deal. And if that's the case, Amber, would you be one of them?
Well, I'm acknowledging the fact that Parliament will try to stop no deal. And I've also said before,
because
previously,
you think it would be so far against the national interest.
But
if that's the case, though, Amber, if it's against your country's and our country's interests, would you be one of those to try to stop it?
I am saying that a new Prime Minister should be able to take the time to do their own deal. This is such an important change in our arrangements.
You've been clear on that. You've been wonderfully clear that that's an ideal outcome.
Well, it depends, John. It depends on what the choices are. I mean, I'm part of a government, and I think this is the right policy, that we do prepare for no deal because it could happen. Mm. So it's. I think that we should do what we can to avoid no deal by finding a deal. But I'm not going to sign up to anything specific to stop no deal because I don't know what the particular route will be.
Well, does that mean you're not ruling anything out? There's an obvious question. You're a senior minister in this government. It's a pretty safe bet you would be one in the next one. Could you serve in a government that was set on a no deal Brexit? Could you serve in that government? I'd always assumed, Amber, you could not.
But no, none of the candidates are saying they want to do
no
deal
Brexit.
No,
if that's the direction we end up taking.
All candidates have said that their preference is to have a deal,
sure,
and they will work hard to do that.
So
I would be honoured to be part of a cabinet that's trying to find the way to do that. No candidate is going to make, I don't believe, no deal their primary objective.
No,
they wouldn't
and
get the support of MPs to do
that. Well, on what's being said anyway, we know that that's not being suggested, but it is, you'll accept, a completely reasonable even obvious question. Given where you stand, could you, do you feel, serve in a government that was heading for no deal? That's a kind of a yes or no, really.
No, John, I don't think it is, because that's not the language of government. I mean, you ask that to every candidate, and they all say none of us are doing that.
Well, the language of government and of politics is to duck the question and fudge. I just wonder, can you say you would leave a government set on no deal?
I'm going to wait and see how a government behaves, because I've been in cabinet and I've been out of cabinet, and I know where you have more influence.
Okay, that's an interesting answer, which gives us some sort of hint of where you're heading. But as you say, we shall see and no doubt come back to all of that. I want to bring in Katie Balls and Matt in just a moment. Let me ask you this before we wind it up again, if I may. We see a report today that the Prime Minister, Theresa May, has it in mind to commit £29 billion to education. She was there when they pushed through £20 billion extra overtime for health, and the suggestion is she wants to do that for education as part of her legacy. Trouble is, she's just days from leaving the place, from leaving that office. Do you think she's got any remote chance of getting a thing like that through now?
It's been clear for a while that this government wants to put more money into education. There's an education funding formula coming up at the end of July, so I don't know what the exact timing is, but I think it would be consistent with what this government's trying to do, which is to improve education, that we will be putting some more money in. I don't know what the timing's going to be.
Yeah, it just seems a little far-fetched, the way politics works, and not just an outgoing, but a pretty much gone prime minister is going to say, OK, £29 billion for that with my name on it, you know, whatever the next prime minister may choose to do. And we know they've got any number of plans of their own.
I don't think any candidate would be against putting more money into education. Mm. And I don't think it matters whose name was on it. I think what matters is that we do the best for the schools that we're trying to help.
Yeah. Well, without being cynical, I sort of think it does matter whose name is on it from the point of view of the person who's writing their name on it. Katie Balls.
Hi, Amber. Katie Balls from The Spectator here. Now, talking about stopping no deal, I know you've been clear that you would want to know how specifically it might be might occur when Parliament tried to stop it. But the route which appears to be the clearest way to stop a no-deal Brexit if everything else fails is voting down the government. Now, there's been hints that there are a handful of Conservative MPs who have suggested publicly that they would consider doing this if that was a last resort to stopping a no-deal Brexit. Can I check now, you would rule out voting down the government to stop a no-deal Brexit? That would be a step too far for you.
It would be a step too far for me. But you're right, there are a number of colleagues who have gone public saying that they would consider doing that.
Yeah.
And there are a number I know of privately who say that. So any candidate needs to factor that in as well into their strategy for the next few months.
So the numbers are easily there, Amber?
I believe they are, yes.
Matt Ford.
Amber, I just wonder, and I understand the position in your own seat, why you didn't stand for the leadership?
Oh, well, that's very flattering of you, Matt, but the Conservative
He didn't say
Party,
he was going to vote for you. Not that he's a Tory man.
The Conservative Party membership definitely wants somebody who is an enthusiast for Brexit. Now, I've said very publicly that I'm committed to it and I want to make sure that we deliver on it carefully, delivering on the outcome of the referendum. I mean, I spent a lot of time supporting Remain in the referendum, and I was very clear that I would help deliver it if that's what happened. So I feel that I must do that, and I want to do that. And I think there's a way of doing it where we can make the country just as strong as it has been before. But my concern is about no deal. And the Tory party membership takes a different view, really. They are much more enthusiastic about no deal than I am.
It just feels, though, that we've been given quite a narrow leadership contest. And, you know, the classic Tory battles of years gone by, whether it's IDS against Ken Clark, where you're given two very different Tory futures, the countries and the parties presented with. It feels like we haven't been given that this time. And I just think you would have been such a strong contender for the One Nation or the left Remainer side of the party. And it feels that everyone's had to talk about Brexit.
Well, one of the things I'm pleased about is that we have really corralled a big voice for the One Nation group of Conservative MPs. And I note that all candidates, when they're making their pitch, throw the words One Nation into it. Some of them are more convincing than others. But actually, I would like to see much more of the candidates being interrogated and having real challenge on some of their proposals. Because, you know, this isn't just about choosing a leader of the Conservative Party. We know it's about choosing a new Prime Minister. And I think it's right that everybody should be put under the sort of interrogation that's appropriate, and that the members realise that it's not just about them. I acknowledge they're only the ones who have a vote, but it's also about the whole country. And as this process continues, opinion polls will show us who the rest of the country really support, and that will influence the members. So it's, although the members are the only ones with the votes, it's going to be a much wider influencing participation as well because of the polling that will continue.
That was a party political broadcast on behalf of Amber Rudd, delivered by Matt Ford, who was also a member of the Labour Party.
Not anymore.
No, he's left the Labour Party, so even more conviction in all of that. Amber, before you go, you may have seen this polling pouring out every day. There's some more in the Sunday Times today, which shows an astonishing lack of trust in politicians generally, in politics as a whole, and in these present candidates for the prime ministership. We've got Boris Johnson. Apparently, he is thought most likely to win. He's also got numbers which say only one in six people would buy a second-hand car from him.
That many?
It is, as Matt says, because you enjoyed that one, Amber. What do you reckon? Do you think in this campaign, and maybe before, has the country been lied to? Have our politicians, senior politicians, been lying to us?
Well, they say campaign in poetry, govern in prose, don't they? I think that we need to be much more upfront with people. I think, I won't use that term, John, but because I don't want to inflame the sort of the already difficulties between politicians and some of their critics. But I do think we need to be much straighter with the British people.
OK, I'm going to leave it there. Lovely to talk to you, Amber Rudd.
Thank you.
Now let's say hi to our next guest coming to the studio. Hello, Victoria. It's Victoria Atkins, the Prime Minister and, by the way, a supporter of Sajid Javid. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I'm going to start with this, which is right in your desk, as it were. I mean, Sajid Javid, the Home Secretary, your chosen candidate, he's promising 20,000 more police to be recruited as part of his pitch for the top job, which I suppose, arguably, it's got to be a good thing, hasn't it? It also means, I guess, that it was a mistake to cut police numbers by 20,000 since 2010.
Well, I think the Home Secretary has made it clear since he came into the Home Office a year ago that increasing funding for the policing for police is a priority of his, and he's now able to set out his stall as part of the leadership campaign. But I have to say, it's one of the reasons, because he has served as Home Secretary and he's had to deal with some of the most difficult issues facing our country, from Windrush through to national security issues. It's one of the reasons why I'm supporting him, because I've seen him, you know, in the office working day in, day out.
And it follows then, he will think it was a mistake, it was a wrong choice of priority to cut police numbers in the way that has been done under spending cuts in very recent years. That's just A follows B follows A.
Well, he was also successful in getting the largest increase in funding. The largest increase in funding since 2010. I mean, we all know we had to take some very difficult decisions in 2010 with the public finances.
At some cost, though, Victoria, when you look at the crime figures. I know they tell different stories depending which figures you look at, but when you look at the level of violent crime, for example, you look at knife crime. It's a big issue on your desk.
It's a huge issue
at the moment. The cuts in police numbers did that problem no good at all.
Well, John, you will know from previous interviews we've had that tackling serious violence isn't simply about the police. It's although, of course, the police are a vital part of that, but it's also looking at things like the key drivers of serious violence, which includes drugs.
Well, which also, in which police numbers are very important.
That's why we're having a huge review of drugs law at the insistence of the Home Secretary, precisely to try and work out what the chief drivers of demand and supply are.
Yeah.
But we've always been very clear in the last year or so that police funding is going to be a priority for the Home Secretary, and indeed he's made that clear that will continue as Prime Minister. And it's precisely, as I say, because of his experience in the Home Office that he's got that sort of experience to be able to walk straight into Number 10 and do the job. But there isn't a lead-in time when you're elected the leader of the Conservative Party, you're made the Prime Minister, you walk into Number 10 and suddenly the door closes, you will have all sorts of briefings on national security,
on immigration.
Exactly right, on all sorts of these issues. And so that's why I think Sajid's experience as Home Secretary and his successes as Home Secretary bode very well for the future.
And he's in charge of this department and you're in this department where immigration policy is such an important issue, especially after Brexit, assuming we do Brexit, where we'll be supposedly taking back control of immigration. Now, Sajid Javid, I've seen a number of his speeches now, quite a few. He's proud of being the son of a Pakistani bus driver who became Home Secretary and now a contender for Prime Minister. He's got every right to be proud of that. It is quite an achievement. What chance would Sajid Javid's dad have of getting into Britain to raise a son to be Prime Minister or anything else today, and especially after Brexit?
Well, I mean, you know, Sajid, because Sajid and his family have lived that life, they, you know, he talks himself most movingly about the transformation that his education, the chances he's been given in this country have led to.
And his dad getting into this country, you know, with nothing much behind him, drove a bus, worked hard all his life, got his son into a glittering career in financial services, and now into the top of politics. Could that happen now? Would Sajid Javid, if he was the Home Secretary, have to tell Sajid's dad if he turned up at the border, sorry, you can't come in?
Well, there are various routes into this country.
And what's the route for a Pakistani bus driver?
So for Sajid, I don't want to sort of personalise it to
any
Sajid's
dad,
but there are routes in for family members. But we've also had to, you know, we have also listened to people's concerns over immigration and the impact it's having in local areas. I mean, I represent a seat in Lincolnshire that is next door to Boston Skegness that has the highest density of Eastern Europeans the country,
we want to make them part
of our country. It's about balance.
I thought, speaking of balance, I thought we'd moved away from the idea of the Home Office. I thought it was said that we were going to move away from the idea of the Home Office as a hostile environment to migrants. And yet you have, I discussed this on this show just last week, you've got universities, you've got companies being refused permission to have academics from Africa coming to this country for seminars or to take training, including training in controlling pandemic diseases. And the judgment has been it's because they're coming from Africa and because the Home Office won't let them in. And so these conferences are taking places in countries like Belgium. The door is simply being closed. It looks like a hostile environment, Victoria, doesn't it?
But and Sajid wants to change that perception. It isn't a hostile environment in that we're trying to make balanced decisions on immigration. And Sajid's been very clear. He wants to get rid of the target. He wants to talk about qualities and skills.
But the situation I've just described, that looks like a hostile environment, arguably, to me, but not to you.
Well, in terms of universities, there aren't any limits on university students being able to come in.
No, these are academics
overseas.
Coming and just being allowed in with visas for a particular course or to take part in a particular event.
Well, as I say, the Sajid has lived this journey, his family's lived this journey, and this is precisely why I think, he would be such a positive Prime Minister in that he understands absolutely what these concerns that people have about immigration, not just as a constituency MP, but also his own family, the own experiences they've had courtesy of our country.
Okay, that sounded like an encouraging message that in office as Prime Minister, he would take a more sympathetic view of these things and more sensitive. I don't quite get why you've got to be Prime Minister to do that when you're the Home Secretary now.
Well, I'm very privileged and honoured to serve as a member of Theresa May's government. Of course, the Home Secretary runs the Home Office, but it is as a result of collective responsibility around the Cabinet table. And of course, the Prime Minister sets the direction of travel.
He couldn't break the bonds that were being wrapped around him by Theresa May.
This is why this contest is so important, because we've got the various candidates setting out their visions for the future. I think Sajid's vision is very positive. It's why I'm supporting him. And I think, it's not... It's about how we as a modern 21st century country both look, feel, and we want to make sure that we look like a welcoming country for all the new relationships that we're going to build after Brexit.
OK, Katie Balls.
Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Katie.
Katie Balls and the Spectators. So the US President Donald Trump has criticised London Mayor Sadiq Khan today in light of knife crime in the capital, and he's called him a national disgrace who is destroying London. I was wondering, speaking for the government, do you have anything to say in Sadiq Khan's defence here?
We have always said that knife crime and serious violence, there are many, many drivers behind it. I'm pleased that the mayor has now set up the violence reduction unit, which is having an impact in London. We're beginning, although I'm very conscious of events this weekend, but the figures were beginning to look as though they were going in the right direction. I do not want to, I'm being very, very cautious in the way I describe that, because I'm conscious that every single incident is a terrible loss for the families and and for friends and community around them. But I do think that, that there's a marked contrast between how Boris was as London mayor tackling serious violence and Sadiq. I mean, there was a real sense of energy with Boris on this particular issue when he was mayor of London. I'm pleased now Sadiq is showing some of that energy, but it's, you know, it's a teamwork. We've got to support the police in what they're doing, but also ensure that we're investing in the sorts of projects that help divert children and young people away from serious violence.
So would you say to President Trump, keep your hands off our London mayor?
I'm suddenly getting alarm bells ringing in my brain, telling President Trump what to do with his hands at all. But I think, look, I'm, you know, Boris Johnson was a great mayor of London. I'm really pleased he's in the leadership race. But I think for me, Sajid is the candidate to take us forward in terms of leadership of the party in the country.
Matt Ford,
there's a problem Sajid has, isn't there? Whether it's on the hostile environment or whether it's about police numbers, is the options are either A, he disagreed with government policy and was unable to convince the Prime Minister and his other colleagues, in which case, what sort of leader would he be? Or he did agree with the cuts and he did agree with the hostile environment. So which is it?
Well, I think you look at the evidence. I think if you look at the fact that he secured more than £1 billion extra funding for the police this year, and there was a specific extra £100 million set aside in the spring statement to deal with tackling knife crime, that was a quite extraordinary
On the 20,000, it just suggests that he's not very capable around the cabinet table.
Well, and let's not forget, you know, he's been Home Secretary for a year. Those decisions have been taken many, many years before him. I'm not for a moment stepping away from the approach of the coalition or the Conservative government, but the fact is he has only been Home Secretary for a year. He was also brought in to deal with Windrush, and that has been an incredibly difficult and a very, very difficult situation for everybody involved, including, of course, those people most directly involved. And Sajid was brought in precisely because he was considered to be able to deal with it. And we are helping people with the Windrush situation.
So it's fair to, as it were, distill that answer of yours, that last answer, into saying not only was Theresa May trying to bind his hands as Home Secretary, but so was the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, and Phil Hammond would be sacked when Sajid becomes Prime Minister.
Again, I'm not going to be promising or not promising colleagues places in the Cabinet. I think that would be getting a little bit ahead of myself. But
I guess you might.
But, you know, like every Cabinet Minister around the table, they and every Minister indeed, we're all bound by collective responsibility. You make your representations in private, and then the PM and the Cabinet make the final decisions, and we're all bound by that decision.
OK, good to see you. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Okay, we're gonna be talking in just a short while to Kwasi Kwarteng, the Brexit Department Minister who's backing Boris Johnson, and also to the up-and-coming young leader of the resurgent Liberal Democrats, Vince Cable. I'm John Pienaar, this is Pienaar's Politics, and Casey Balls is here from The Spectator, and Matt Ford, a political commentator and comedian. And Casey, I guess all political commentators are comedians now, whether it's intentional or not, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's gallows humour at the moment when you're covering certain...
Not quite as bad as waiting
there,
to be hanged.
I think we've been given plenty of material to work with, so perhaps those jokes come sometimes about you aren't necessarily intending them.
Yeah, and hi to Kwasi Kwarteng, a minister in the Brexit department. Kwasi, you are a supporter of Boris Johnson.
That's right.
As I said, is that why you're looking so relaxed? Nothing can go wrong now.
No, lots can go wrong.
What can go wrong?
No one is taking anything for granted.
What can go wrong, Kwasi?
Well, we know the elections. I mean, the last 3 years, all the pundits and people like yourself said that, you know, Trump would lose, Hillary would win, Brexit wouldn't happen, we'd get a stonking great majority in 2017. None of that happened. So lots of surprises, I think, could emerge.
Yeah.
Yes, Boris is in a strong position, but we're taking nothing for granted.
It looks, stress looks, not that it is, but it looks nailed on. I mean, what weakness now could Boris Johnson's opponents possibly target to take him down?
Well, the thing is about Boris is that he's been a public figure for 20 years. So I can't think of any person in the public eye who's had more brickbats, more, frankly, abuse hurled at him, accusations, all sorts of accusations. And I think, but who knows where the next attacks will come from.
Yeah.
I'm sure there will come. I'm sure there's a plan to stop Boris. There always is a plan to stop a front runner, which he is.
Yeah.
But I hope that the you know, the campaign can come to a successful conclusion.
Yeah.
But let's see. It's nothing is written in the stars. Nothing is nailed on.
It's not over. And as you say, he's had an interesting and colourful and quite a long career. All those, you know, often heard character questions, the flip-flopping, the gaffes, the endless thick file of cuttings about a tangled private life. It just seems to wash off, though, doesn't it? Why is that?
Because ultimately people are not interested in what happened 20 years ago or 10 years ago. They want to have someone who can lead, someone who can actually bring strong team together, who can campaign very effectively. And I had one criterion when I wanted to look. They were all good candidates, as far as I was concerned. But I wanted to ask, who was the most effective campaigner of all the leadership candidates? And for me, Boris Johnson was outstanding in that particular department. The other candidates, less convincing for me.
Yeah, there's always a but, and here's a but. This stuff, you can't say it doesn't matter. They do bear argument.
I don't think it does.
Let me put the question.
Sure.
When it matters of character, what does he believe? So many people, including supporters of Boris Johnson, would say what Boris believes in is Boris Johnson. There's a woman languishing in an Iranian jail, which you could argue it's not just because of Boris Johnson speaking
Boris
out of
Boris didn't put her in the jail.
He didn't
it
put
was
her
the
in the
Iranian
jail
government
either, but clearly he didn't help. That cannot be. That can be said. It didn't.
Well, she's
didn't
still there.
Really
We're still trying to negotiate, and
sure.
Jeremy Hunt is trying.
But you're
to
not
do
saying,
that.
Are you, Kwasi, that these things don't matter?
No, of course they matter, and absolutely, what Boris wants and what I want is scrutiny, and that's what the media are providing. He's, you know, we've said that he wants to do the debate on Tuesday. I think there'll be lots of debates if he gets into the final two. There'll be lots of hustings. I think 15 or 20. And there'll be lots of opportunity to go through all these issues.
Mm.
What I said was that he's been in the public eye for a very long time, and a lot of these accusations have been made ad nauseam many times years ago.
On his skates, as you said. Is that quasi because of his underappreciated statesmanship, or because a lot of Tory MPs think he's the guy to keep them in their seats?
Well, I think it's not really unusual for a Tory MP to want to have a winner.
Or any other MP.
Or any other MP to want to have a winner in charge of their party. I mean, that's a natural thing to want. He's got a proven track record as an election winner.
Mm.
And also, I think that people generally, I think this is a more broader point, this is how I see it. I think the last 2 or 3 years, people have felt very bad about the country. They feel despondent. And one thing Boris is very good at is projecting a sense of optimism, a sense of dynamism, energy, and a self-belief in the country, not just in himself, which people accuse him of, but I think in the country. He is an uplifting candidate. And I think there's a real demand, if you like, for something a bit more uplifting, a bit more inspirational than what people say to me is a very managerial approach that we've had, perhaps, in the last 2 years.
OK, let me ask you this. A genuine question. You're a supporter of Boris Johnson. He's the guy, as far as you're concerned.
I'm not a very close friend of his.
I know him. You think he's a good? He's the
I
right
think he's
guy.
a good person. Yeah.
Okay. You're also black.
Yeah.
So just tell me you yourself. What do you feel about a potential prime minister who calls Muslim women in burqas bank robbers and has called Africans flag waving pickaninnies?
So the flag waving pickaninnies was he was talking about a UN report, and if you read the article, he was essentially imagining himself as one of these UN reporters who are very hypocritical. That particular article, I think, was about 16 years ago.
Oh, it was a long time
and
ago.
Actually,
yeah.
And the funny thing is that I was a candidate in 2008 in the mayoral election,
yeah.
And all these accusations were hurled at him then. Now, if you want to look at his record in terms of race relations...
But it's also true that he apologised for those remarks.
He did, and I'm surprised you brought them back 16 years later.
No, because I want to hear your remarks.
And if you actually saw what he did as a mayor... people across London, across many communities in London, said he was actually very good at engaging with voters who weren't naturally Conservative voters.
Mm.
And when he won in 2012, the Conservative Party was 17 points behind Labour. So he did have that reach. He did have that ability to connect to different communities. And that's exactly why I'm and many other Tory MPs are supporting him this time.
Yeah. And you can see, if we're being completely objective and fair, why a reference to British Muslim women as bank robbers because they wear burqas and and look through.
So again, the article, people regard it as inflammatory language, but the article was actually defending the right of women to wear burqas. You go across,
also mocking.
You go across to the EU. You go across to the EU. He was defending. Ultimately, he was defending the right of people to wear burqas. Mm. You go across to the EU. That you have burqa bans in France. You have burqa bans in other countries in Europe. And he was defending actually a British tradition of tolerance and acceptance of people, you know, from different faiths and cultures.
Yeah. Look, okay. I want to bring in Matt and Katie in just a second, but just before the news. You may have heard Amber Rudd saying that she believes the numbers are there in the House of Commons, some of them public, she knows of others privately, who would be prepared to bring the government down then, a vote of confidence, rather than allow the country to go unimpeded into a no-deal Brexit. What do you say to that?
Well, let's see what happens. I mean, many of the same people who predicted...
Do you know the sort of people she's talking to?
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask her who these MPs are. Yeah. But there was certainly a vote last week, which the government won. I don't think there's an appetite in the country or even in the House of Commons for another general election. Mm. And let's see. I read all the time people like yourself, other commentators in the newspapers, saying there's almost certainly going to be a general election. I'm not so sure. These people were the same people who said that Theresa May would get a huge majority. They were the same people who said that Brexit would never happen. They were the same people who said that Trump would never get elected. So they don't have a very good record in terms of predicting the future. And now the same people are saying that there's almost certainly going to be an election. I'm not so sure. I don't think there will be one.
The only thing we know is that we don't know.
Exactly.
Casey Balls.
When it comes to things we don't know, we do know some ways potentially for delivering a no-deal Brexit in the face of a Commons which has repeatedly said they don't want one. Now, Boris Johnson has been very clear that the UK needs to leave by the end of October, no extension. There is some talk that one way that you could get this to happen if MPs were going to try and thwart it would be to prorogue Parliament. No one seems entirely sure if Boris Johnson has ruled this out. There are some reports that he has suggested to senior Brexiteers he would consider it as an option. So, Kwasi, what I wondered was, Wella, do you think proroguing Parliament, so suspending Parliament and therefore just waiting for the UK to leave the EU would be an acceptable way to deliver Brexit?
I don't think any Prime Minister will prorogue Parliament in order to deliver Brexit. I don't think that's necessary. I think it's quite inflammatory talk. I think it was Dominic Raab, one of the candidates, who brought that up. I didn't understand why he'd done that because I don't think it's necessary.
Necessary? Would it be wrong?
Well, I'm not a constitutional expert. I think in terms of the spirit of the law, it would be wrong. According to the letter of the law, I'm not sure it's illegal.
I just wonder in general about Boris's character when you say, oh, a lot of these things were 16 years ago. It's not that long ago. And I think if you're going to lead a country, it doesn't matter when you were a git, whether it was 5 minutes ago, whether it was 10 years ago. This says something about his character. And there was a story in the Daily Mirror about him in a meeting about the families of the 7/7 bombing victims, where this is Brian Coleman, who was chair of the London Fire and Emergency Planning Authority, claims that Mr Johnson joined the meeting, erupted and said, F the families, F the families. Now, we know he said F business in the past. The way that he presents himself in public is this harmless joker. Mm. Behind the scenes, he comes across as a nasty individual who actually doesn't care about the most vulnerable
Let's
people.
Let's let Kwasi answer that one, really.
So, the conversation was 14 years ago, and it's funny how it's just come up now. All that time... No one has breathed a word about this. Mm. And now all of a sudden I'm answering your question. This is my point. What I'm saying is that in the course of this leadership, all sorts of things will be hurled at him. Yeah. New things that I'd never even heard of. I wasn't there at the in the room, so I don't know what he said. But it's funny how all these conversations that happened years ago are suddenly surfacing when he's now the front runner for the leadership.
We could go on, as you can imagine, for quite some time. We'll have other opportunities. Going to break this one off there. Forgive me. We can talk to the up-and-coming, young, thrusting new star of politics, Sir Vince Cable. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Good to hear from you, Vince. So, look, you've got a few things, if not to celebrate, then maybe to take some quiet satisfaction. You look at the latest polls, just a point or two, the Liberal Democrats behind Labour and the Conservatives. It's a comeback, Vince, and you're the comeback kid then.
Well, some of them actually have us ahead of them. But you're right, that to the extent to which we can gauge public opinion, there seems now to be four parties with roughly equal levels of support. Mm. What I derive satisfaction from isn't just the European elections, but the local elections before it. That, in a way, was what gave us the breakthrough. And it wasn't just luck. I mean, we had been solidly plugging away at the grassroots for months and years. I devoted a lot of time and effort to it, and it came good. So we don't just have national appeal based on current issues, but we've restored our local infrastructure, and we're in a very strong position should a general election come soon.
Yeah. Look, Vince, there's a time and a place for modesty, and maybe this isn't it. I mean, do you think any Liberal Democrat leader could have got your party into the position you're in now? Or do you have something to do with it? And if you do have something to do with it, what have you done that's helped bring about this surge in Lib Dem support? You?
Well, I like to think that, you know, my patient approach worked. And there is a statement, I think, goes back to Napoleon, that if you want a successful general, the first thing you need is luck. To some extent, I've had that.
Oh, so you're a lucky, successful general. Why are you going then? Surely this is the wrong time to be stepping down.
Well, I don't adopt an opportunistic approach to this. I said a few months ago that I wanted to get the party to a good position and then to hand over to the next generation in an orderly way. And I like these things to be done in a planned, not in a panicky way. We've got very good people coming through, two contestants in the leadership election. I'm very happy to hand over to them.
Must be a bit of regret, though. You must wish you were able to be there to see through the surge.
Well, I probably will still be there in some capacity. I mean, I'm continuing as the MP in Twickenham, and I'm very proud of that role. And I will continue to be active in the party. But I'm very happy for others to take over the leadership role. Yeah,
I don't want to rain on the parade, which is now in full flight, and balloons flying, Vince. But, you know, let me ask you this, though. I mean, you weren't you all for doing some kind of a deal with Change UK, you know, before the European elections, and afterwards you thought one would be inevitable, maybe some kind of alliance. And now look, the Liberal Democrats are eating them alive. They've splintered, and some of them have joined you, Chuka and Munna. Who knows, maybe Heidi Allen or Sarah Wollaston, the Tory MPs, may be with you soon. Your plan would have sold your party short.
Well, you know, it's easy to have retrospective wisdom. I think it was the right thing to do. I think in the country, the Remainers, who I think are now a majority of the population, do want the various parties which are trying to stop Brexit and seek a second referendum, they do want them to work together. And I reflected that. I think Change unwisely decided to go it on their own, and you've seen the consequences.
So now you look forward to gobbling them up.
Well, I'm not gobbling them up. I mean, some of them will join us. Some of them will stay as independents. You know, and I'm, you know, would respect either position. The important thing is we continue to work together, because as you've revealed in your earlier discussions with these two Conservatives, we were in very dangerous times. And, you know, the whole Brexit issue is far from resolved. And I'm very keen that the people on the other side of the argument, you know, are working together. You know, whatever formulation is less important.
In Matt Ford.
Do you think there would be some sort of, I mean, obviously the Change thing has kind of happened now, but some form of Remain alliance, would the Lib Dems still be open to that? I mean, Chuka and Munna's speech the other day I thought was superb, and as someone who is counts himself among the politically homeless, I have to say I'm looking at the Liberal Democrats now in a way that I never thought I would, and with a great deal of hope. And I think you are doing a fantastic job, frankly, at giving those of us who are internationalist, pro-European, but, you know, of a liberal centrist persuasion, something to really get behind, but there's still a long way to go. So
that was a relatively historic moment there on Peanuts.
I'm not sure it was. But do you think there is there still a way that you can get either Labour MP? Well, there you go. I suppose that's the question. Are you talking to Labour MPs similar to the Chuka and Munna ilk to come over to you?
Yes, we are. We're talking to quite a lot of Labour people and Conservatives. I think, in a way, at the moment, it's the Conservatives who are most fragile, you know, given the way that their party's lurching to the no-Brexit extreme. And we are talking to them.
Is that like
I think
an
your question originally was whether there
people.
Should be
what
a Remain alliance, and I'm certainly very much open to that.
Yeah. Are you making any progress, Vince?
Well, we're making progress in the sense that I think the tribal culture that prevented us talking to each other before is breaking down. I think people realise that this is a national emergency and that, you know, the country matters ahead of party. And, you know, whether people join us or not, some will, some won't. But I think what is more important is that we work together. And I think your phrase of the Remainer alliance is absolutely the right one.
Kizzy balls.
Hi Vince, Katie Balls from The Spectator here. You mentioned that you're in discussions with certain Conservative MPs about joining the Liberal Democrats. Now I wondered if you thought there would be a trigger that might bring them over, and if that trigger might be Boris Johnson becoming the leader of the Tory party.
Well, I'm talking to Conservatives about common areas, notably stopping Brexit and particularly stopping a hard Brexit. Whether they join us, you know, I hope, but that may not happen. I think the trigger point is probably in the autumn rather than now. There probably will be a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson if he becomes leader in the next few weeks.
It can, by the way, Vince, be a vote of confidence in Boris Johnson as opposed to the government. So not one that necessarily brings the government down. Is that your
Well, in the short run, then I suspect that most of the Tories will rally behind him, if not all. But if it does become in the autumn clear that he hasn't got a different version of the withdrawal agreement, and is preparing to let us fall out of the European Union or deliberately to crash out, then there will be a motion of no confidence. And I think he will lose because there is now a critical mass of Tories, including very senior ones like the Chancellor, who have made it very clear they won't go along with it.
So you think Boris Johnson becoming Prime Minister will be helpful for bringing Conservative MPs to the Lib Dems?
Yes, possibly. But he is as even his friends explain, he's a very unscrupulous and opportunistic individual. I mean, there is a scenario in which he does a U-turn and acknowledges that Brexit's just too difficult. I wouldn't entirely put that past him.
Yeah. On the other side of that coin, maybe the edge of that coin, if the Labour Party shifts to Remain and the pro-referendum position becomes Labour's position, then your comeback, Vince, could be very short-lived, couldn't it? You must be praying for Len McCluskey, say, to keep the faith and hold the line against the people's vote.
No, not at all. And I take comfort whenever leading Labour people do speak up for Remain. I'm certainly not seeing this in terms of opportunities for the party. I think what was very significant over the last 2 weeks is that after the Peterborough by-election, Jeremy Corbyn decided to double down on his existing position of constructive ambiguity, which is disastrous for them and for the country. So I don't see any signs that they are shifting decisively in that direction. Okay, I wish they would.
But I mean, whether or not you wish this, then if Labour does make that shift, it would take a lot of the steam out of your balloon, wouldn't it?
It might, but we're not just campaigning on Brexit, of course. I think people are looking to sensible, middle-of-the-road party and with good policies and good values, and we offer that too. But no, Brexit is a critical issue. I think after the last 2 years, nobody really trusts the Labour Party leadership to give full-hearted backing to remaining in the European Union. Jeremy Corbyn's gone so far down the Brexit road and the ambiguity road that there's no way they're going to row back from that now. Nobody would believe them.
I agree with Vince, and I think even if Corbyn shifts to a people's vote position, I think the damage is already done, and I think there is something far more profound happening between Labour and its members and its supporters. And it's not just about Brexit. Brexit has really flushed out the instincts of the leadership, and they've been found to be insular and not internationalist, and that's quite aside from the anti-Semitism problem. And I think just cynically shifting in order to now try and get those people back, I don't think it'd do the job. I think people are looking at the Liberal Democrats now in a different way, and I think once people get in the habit of not voting Labour when they voted for them their whole lives, it's very hard to get them back.
Yeah, and do you agree with that? I should point out that Matt is almost a Liberal Democrat. So
no, thank you. Maybe somebody here we should hire for our publicity.
I mean, I think if you look at the European election results, it showed that the two main parties were losing what are their core voters, the Labour to Lib Dems, Tories a lot to the Brexit Party. And the question is, can they get that back by now changing their Brexit position? And I do think in both cases, a lot of damage has been done over the past 2 years. And it's just pivoting to a clearer Brexit position might not be enough to get everyone.
OK, Laura, thanks. Let's talk to Vince there. Thank you very much indeed, Vince, for coming on. That was a really interesting conversation.
Thank you very much for coming in too.
Pleasure. Thank you, Casey. And to all of our other guests today. I'm going to pick up some of these threads, by the way, with some Labour voices next week, because this stuff ain't going to go away. I want to hear what they've got to say about this stuff, because that's such a fascinating story too. And that was PNR's Politics then for another week. Katie and Matt are still with me. What's the takeaway? I suppose you've got to say Amber was interesting.
Yes, I think Amber Rudd clearly, we know for some time she does not want a no-deal Brexit, but it appeared today that she went further in laying out how she thinks it will be avoided. And she said she didn't know the specifics of the ways they might use an activist speaker in John Bercow, but I suppose what you might call the nuclear option, the option which is the clearest way to stop a no-deal Brexit, which is a vote of confidence in the government, or a no confidence vote to be more specific. Yeah. She said she believed the numbers were there in the Tory party, or a mix of Tory MPs who have already publicly said they would do it. That's people like Ken Clark, Dominic Grieve, and Conservative MPs she has privately spoken to. So she is in effect saying...
And it was an entirely unequivocal answer. Yeah. She said the numbers were there. And the really, I suppose, interesting and important thing is we know there's a majority in the House of Commons. We've known it for what feels like ever. There's a majority against leaving with no deal. What she was firming up there and putting in her own words is that even if it came to the idea of voting against the government, this is, by the way, a crime in any party that results in being deprived of the whip. It results in being not able to stand as an MP candidate at the next general election. It is about as big as it gets. And that's aside from the way it would be seen in that party, by so many at least, as the ultimate betrayal. But she saw that as being very much on the cards.
Yeah, she believes there are enough MPs in her party to bring down their own government if you have a Brexiteer Prime Minister, and that would be someone like Boris Johnson, who actually doesn't blink and pushes for a no-deal Brexit. And I do think that is quite a big moment. Now, she herself said she wouldn't go so far, but she clearly is fine with some of her colleagues doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is part of the change in politics, isn't it? Is that people's loyalty to their own party... Even people who are, I mean, Amber Rudd is something of a grandee these days in the modern Tory party, prize staying in the European Union and that relationship and that the values that go with that more than they do a party label. And obviously Heidi Allen, Sarah Wollaston and Anna Soubry have been part of that. Nick Bowles is part of that. Dominic Grieve is part of that. And it's happened on the Labour side as well. And I just think these are all the early warning signs. These are the cracks in the earth beneath our feet in fundamental changes in how our politics are. And Nigel Farage has branded his party very shrewdly, the Brexit Party. And I just think on the other side, whatever it is, you know, the Lib Dems are part of that conversation. Obviously, we talked to Vince towards the end. But I think there is something else that will happen, something grander on the other side, where if you were to have a party that was Amber Rudd, Vince Cable, Chuka Rumuna, it would be far more effective and far more appealing, I believe, to the people of Britain than any of the parties currently.
Well, that makes an absolutely gripping next chapter to the book. But so far, that's fiction, although nothing is knowable. You said something big's on the way. Clearly, this is you imagining something rather than knowing something, but still interesting, and you gave a hint there. What do you reckon the next big, big thing will be?
Well... It is interesting to see how the Tory party reacts to, say, a Boris premiership and a Boris possibly presiding or trying to deliver no deal.
You reckon a split? You reckon a physical split?
I think the fact that Heidi Allen, Sarah Wollaston and Anna Soubry left pre-Boris, that Nick Bowles couldn't stand it pre-Boris, and that was under Theresa May trying to get a deal, I just think this would be a nuclear reaction in the heart of the Tory party. It would change what the Tory party is to those people, I think.
Do you reckon, Katie?
Yeah, I think if Boris Johnson becomes Prime Minister and actually goes for a no-deal Brexit, I think there's some Tory MPs who are fine with Boris Johnson government because they don't actually think he's going to do it. I think that would potentially see people quitting the party, or, as Amber Rudd talked about, bringing down the government. But I think broadly, I don't know how big that split would be. I think you would potentially have some Conservative MPs splinter off to the Liberal Democrats, which is almost becoming what was supposed to be this new centrist party is now the Liberal Democrats. I think we could be heading to a general election, and on the show, Kwasi Kwarteng's very keen to say that pundits always get these things wrong. But whenever that next general election is, I think there is a serious chance that you see the Conservatives becoming the party of Brexit, so pivoting to a harder Brexit position, and Labour becoming the party of a second referendum, pivoting to that, and you'll have that Brexit election. Now, as Matt said earlier, it might be too late to pick up some of those voters who have already gone Brexit Party or Lib Dem, but I think that's what we seem to be heading for right now with the main parties.
And listening to Vince Cable, I don't care what Vince Cable says, I reckon there's a little bittersweet pang in his chest there. I don't mean that in any medical sense, but just emotionally, the idea of he's leaving now, maybe at the finest moment for his
life. Yeah, but what a gift to be able to leave on a high. I think he, as someone who's been around as long as he has, with the greatest respect to him, he has seen people come and go and crash on the rocks, and I think he will have a philosophical view that actually he's one of the few political leaders that can...
I'm going to get you a yellow rosette.
I would say, I mean, we say that the saying goes, you know, all great political careers end in failure. Yeah. Now, I don't know if everyone would class Vince Cable's in that, but I do think that over time he may end up being rather pleased that he ended on a happy note and almost handed it over, and that could be his legacy. Happier than Theresa May's.
OK, I'm going to leave it there. Next week is going to be gripping. I mean that. Talk to you later.